Good morning. Let me call the council study session of Thursday, December 6th, to order. I do need to excuse Councilmember Whalen, and I think we have a couple other council members that are probably on their way, trying to find their jackets this morning, would be my guess. We have seven items. The first is to hear a presentation to discuss and provide direction on the projects included in the anticipated November 2008 bond election. And we have the inclusion this morning of street lighting projects.
Good morning. Happy holidays. We're Lenny Hume from Transportation, and I are here to hopefully have an illuminating conversation about streetlights this morning. So we brought along some information. I'm going to cover the background history of what's happened with streetlights, and Lenny's going to talk to you a little bit about the city's maintenance programs and budget that we have for street lighting. So background, in the early 1980s, Arizona passed a dark sky ordinance, which meant that we had to get rid of our mercury vapor lamps and change our standards. So early in the 1980s, we implemented new standards for street lighting, and we based those upon a national lighting standard, recommended practice number 8. And now that is our current standard, and we use that for lighting levels, pole spacing, and a variety of requirements for design of streetlights. In 1982 and 2004, the staff came forward, and we did about 30 neighborhood lighting projects using CDBG grant money. And that cost about $5,000 in lamps that went in. $5 million. 2004 to today. Back in 2004, the staff came forward with a plan to look at how many additional neighborhoods beyond those we currently replace streetlights in. And at that time, we came back with about 60 projects to talk to you about and prioritize for CDBG grant funding. Two of those have been built. One is in design, and we spent about $1 million in that program. This is a map. It just shows the completed projects, and these are pretty much right in the heart of the city, about 30 projects that were completed using CDBG grant money. And then this is the map that came forward in 2004 with the city's proposed plan to continue to use CDBG grant money to fund these neighborhoods. You can kind of see right in the middle of the map, it looks like there's a keyhole right in the middle of the map, and that's where the 30 projects are that we completed as part of that funding program. If we look at what street lighting costs us today, because a lot of things have happened and changed the price of street lighting in the last few years. One of them is the price of copper and steel poles. Today, capital costs for a new street light is about $6,500, and the city spends about an additional O&M cost of about $100 per year on each light.
Thanks, Beth. I'm going to go ahead and quickly cover some of our existing budget. One of the programs we just reinstituted after shutting down for about 5-6 years for lack of funding was a spot improvement program, where we carved out $250,000 in our streetlight program to do spot improvements. We had a list of over 100 people requesting lights, and that's just a light to go on areas in which maybe a spacing on a light's too far apart or an intersection needs a light. They've made a request, and we started that program back up. So we spend approximately $250,000 on that, and that gets us about 60 poles. And we, in most cases, try to recycle existing poles. New projects come through, widen the streets. We take those poles back to the North Center Yard Storm and put them back up. Another program we do is our knockdowns. We spend about $500,000 or plus or minus each year for knockdowns and rusted poles. Rusted poles, you have a map it's with all the red dots on it. It shows all our rusted poles throughout the city. We have approximately 8,000 direct burial poles in the city of Mesa. And some of those are rusted, and we replace those throughout our program. Yeah, and one of the things I want to mention about direct burial, in this picture, you'll see up in the upper right-hand corner, top one is actually a direct burial pole. What that is a pole just drilled into the ground, the base, and there's no foundational concrete foundation. It's drilled, put in the ground, and soil packed around it. We also do base-mounted poles. All our new poles are base-mounted poles. that we put in now. Keeps the potential rusting problems we have. Of course, the picture we have there is actually one of the poles we pulled out of Dobson Ranch a while back. It's actually a base mounted pole, so not all cases do they not fail. I mean, we also have base mounted poles fail, but the one in the brown is actually a streetlight pole that we found in Dobson Ranch. Again, that's the top picture is a direct burial. And then just to kind of give you a rough idea, we spend approximately $2 million a year just providing power to the streetlight system, which is a combination of City of Mesa Electric and also SRP. As I mentioned earlier, there's the map kind of shows you the direct burial poles. We first encountered some problems with these poles. We started noticing the bases were rusting out or the bottoms were rusting out. We got some concern and we started doing some calculations trying to figure out what approach we could take to replace these poles. When you start doing the math, we were only averaging maybe 60 to 80 poles a year replacing, and it would take us about 100 years to get to the whole system, and obviously we couldn't do that. So we actually go out and test each one of these poles. We average about a third of the number of direct burials each year, go out and test them, and the ones we find bad, then we go ahead and have those replaced. And if you notice in the center of the picture, as Beth said earlier, we did some CDBG projects, which have eliminated a lot of these poles. As we go through, and we do on a street improvement, we take those poles out, put base mounted ones in.
Okay, and then if you look at the 60 projects we still have outstanding that we know about, that's about $32 million in lighting improvements if we were to do all of them. As a staff, we looked at what we've done in the past, and we do design these projects in-house with in-house staff. They are smaller projects, and they're quite easy. They're easier to do with our in-house staff than they are to consult out. And we've been able to do as many as four or five projects a year when the funding was available. At a staff level, we talked about what is it that we would recommend to you if you wish to put money in the bond election to start addressing some of these projects. And we came back with a staff recommendation of four to five neighborhood projects a year, which would be equivalent to about $2 to $2.5 million per year. Over the five-year bond would be, you know, $10+ million in the budget, and then that would be about 300 to 350 poles a year. So those would be our recommendations if you're interested in putting some additional funding in the bond election today.
Good questions on this one? Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. This has been a concern of mine on a couple of levels. One is that we're taking CDBG money, which I think should more appropriately be used for economic development. CDBG money is block grant money that comes from the federal government to improve communities and specifically for economic development, and there's focus on housing as well. By using it here, it isn't that we didn't improve a community, but we're very limited in what areas we can use it for lighting. Additionally, I think it's taking away from the larger impact that you could have on the broader community in terms of economic development, and yet the street lighting is important. I think that street lighting should go where it appropriately should be, which is under transportation or possibly public safety, but, you know, so it doesn't get confused, just maybe just under transportation. I think that your target of $2 to $2.5 million a year looks like it's something that's achievable. I do have one question, and it goes back to the last time we had a discussion on street lights and pole replacements and all those things, and that's the $500,000 per year that is going to the, I'm trying to flip back to the place on the chart where you had it, Lenny. Knocked down poles. The last time we had this conversation, one of the things that was happening was the city was paying for some of those knocked down poles when somebody didn't have insurance, and I objected to that. I thought we should take them to small claims court. So. Ms. Spinner, you said attorneys can't appear in small claims court, and my recollection is I volunteered to go on behalf of the city because it was so aggravating to me that the people in the community who have insurance were picking up the tabs for people who, it's my understanding, it is illegal not to have insurance, and so it just felt like it was one of those situations that was wrong all the way around. So where are we on that?
Yeah. Mayor, Vice Mayor, we have, based on the council direction, implemented a process in our department where we are working with finance, and we have an attorney dedicated to seeking subrogation claims from individuals who damage city property. I can collect the statistics for you. We started probably about 6 months ago, so I can update you on the progress of that program, but we are pursuing that.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate you doing that.
Mayor and Vice Mayor, just to follow up, we also open a block of billable work orders. So as soon as we have an accident report or something, we know that we can link it back to somebody. We open a billable work order. So I fill out probably 15 of those a month. Just as soon as one happens, we can have at least track the expenditures we have on each one of those.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mayor.
Kyle.
I'll just go a little step further on the CBDG funds. When you say they can be better used than just doing the streetlights, yes, they can be leveraged when we work with nonprofits and other agencies that will leverage those dollars, and we get a lot more bang for the buck on that. So I'm in concurrence about rolling this in a different way than we have been and not using the CDBG for the street lighting projects.
Mayor, Council, just to be clear, I don't think the last time we had CDBG funds for streetlights was about 2 years ago, Ray. Is that correct? So at this point, the only projects that are in there are being completed. I think some have been completed, some are under design. So in the last allocation of CDBG funds, there were not any projects.
Right.
And I think we kind of, the direction, at least I think in our discussions, that I don't know that we had plans for any future streetlights.
Just wanted to clarify, though, that for the future, don't even bring it up.
I think that was consistent with last year,
yeah,
or the current year's
plan,
right. Yeah.
And I voiced somewhat a opposition view to those that you've heard on street lighting, because I thought it was a very tangible long-term safety improvement to the neighborhood, so I thought it was warranted under that program. But there's certainly room for discussion on what those priorities should be. But some of the economic development things are harder to see a result on, and I thought the actual having neighborhood improvements with street lighting was very tangible and very visible, and some neighborhoods that didn't have proper lighting, it makes a dramatic effect on the appearance of the security in those areas. And I think that's kind of why we're talking about doing some more street lighting in some of those areas that need it. Is there the areas that you have highlighted on this future CBG projects, is there some standards that how many poles per feet or how much light to the street? I know we have obviously the Desert Uplands, which wants its own different type of standard, but is there an urban standard that we're trying to meet so we know what the cost is if we go into another neighborhood to do that? Is that all calculated out?
Yes, that recommended practice number 8 from the Illumination Engineering Society is the practice that we follow on the standard.
And that number 8 is one I have not read recently.
So. Yeah, I understand.
7 you knew, but 8,
oh, really?
No.
It's great sleeping
material. I thought it
was material.
80, actually. I thought it had to do with a year of implementation.
It actually has to do with the type of neighborhood or the type of area you're in and how many people are there and use the area. And it has to do with lighting levels or foot candles at the pavement. So if you're in a like a low, an area where you might not have a lot of people out walking around at night, or like a residential neighborhood, you might be at like a 0.4 foot candle. But if you're out around a mall where you have a lot of people and more incidents or opportunities for people to be out with vehicles and things of that nature, you might be at 4 times that, at 1.6.
Right. So, and that standard wasn't set by those people that sell the light poles, was it?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay.
Mayor, I've got a couple of questions.
Oh, go ahead, Daryl.
So, Beth, in a typical residential neighborhood, if there is such a thing, is that a pole every, used to be like 120 to 140 feet or something like that, or whereas the old days it used to be around 200, 250 feet?
It's really around about 180 feet on the pole spacing, 180 to 200 or just over.
And one other comment is we do work for a variety of different communities, and I was going back to the CDBG funds. I've seen communities use those for street lighting projects. I've seen them to use them to pave unpaved streets. That's very common in the county areas and in Queen Creek and other places in the years past. So I just thought I'd make that comment.
Okay.
One other thing is, I guess the intent here is to provide these street lights to these neighborhoods at no cost to these neighborhoods. whereas when we annex in county areas that have that don't have city standards, we expect them to bring their improvements up to all the current city standards. It seems a little bit, no pun intended, like a double standard to me. And have we ever investigated in the past or used things like improvement districts or other mechanisms to install these street lights and then have the community pay for them out over, say, 20 years and where the cost to them wouldn't be that significant?
All right, we'll answer that for you. I'm familiar with some areas where I think we've actually done kind of a street lighting improvement district for them where they haven't annexed, but we've provided some electric power and street poles and then did an assessment. But
Mayor, that's correct. In areas like that where we have special improvement districts, we use an IGA with the county actually to provide street lighting. Ordinarily, if we're annexing in and the land is undeveloped, then we can require those standards. But typically, when we're annexing land in a city that's already developed that has substandard lighting, we don't mandate any enhancements in their lighting standard. And therefore, long term, the odds are that the city would, if we did enhance it, the city would pay for those enhancements. Obviously, when it's undeveloped, they meet our requirements and they have to put the street lighting in. But to date we have, and we certainly have responded to neighborhoods that have talked about substandard streets and street lighting and suggested SIDs, special improvement districts. To that end, we have very few and far between that are interested in doing that.
I guess my suggestion would be is, we talked about partnership and leveraging our money. I almost think that if people were to come forward and say, if we formed an improvement district and did streetlights in our neighborhood or multiple neighborhoods and the city paid half the cost and provided the design for free or something like that, to where we encourage people to help pay for or participate in these things, is something that I would prefer as a program, particularly when we've got so many areas to light. Maybe some of them would be willing to come forward and participate and move to the top of the list. And we would do those at the top of the list first and leverage our money a lot better.
Okay. Kyle?
Most of these we're talking about are not the ones being annexed in and coming in. We're talking about older neighborhoods that have been in the city 50, 60 years or so where the lighting has not been very good. We have most of our direct burial poles. Most of the deterioration, the lack of light and the deterioration of facilities is in existing long-time neighborhoods, and that's the ones we're trying to address the most right now. Obviously, when people are trying to come in to annex and come in from those areas, there needs to be a mechanism, and we have been doing that to have them participate in that cost of bringing them up to standards. But most of what we're talking about is really the old existing neighborhoods from many, many years ago.
I think I confused everybody by making the analogy to the areas being annexed in. The only thing I was trying to do there was address the principle of pay for what you get. But I am also talking about these older areas that are on our list and whether or not they would be willing to participate and see if we couldn't leverage our money better because we don't have that much money to spend.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
Thank you. A lot of these are older areas, and a lot of these issues are public safety issues, which is why the other night when I raised the issue, I talked about potentially putting part of it in public safety, because we are talking about public safety issues frequently in areas where people are not people who have discretionary income or discretionary money to do, or even the neighborhood gathering to put together a special improvement district. I'm looking at this map that you gave us, and it shows the 2004 to the future CDBG priorities, and I raised that issue the other night with CDBG, but one of the other things I said was that there are census tracts that we never considered in here because they didn't fall into the low and mod category. They barely missed. And I have some that are over some really older neighborhoods that were built originally to city standards, and you know, things have changed, and the fact of the matter is the city is no longer a city of, you know, 20,000 people. We're a city of 460,000 people. The lighting standards have changed. And there, you know, in areas like, and I'll give you some neighborhoods, like over by Keno Junior High, where those folks have said to me, they felt like their lighting was inadequate. And you go back and you look at the map, and their census tract, because of how it's split up, doesn't quite qualify. So one of the other things I was interested in was not just looking at the CDBG-eligible census tracts, because that was one of the other issues with using CDBG, that there were only certain areas that you could go, and there were other places in the city that were in just, you know, in just as much need. And so my concern is that we not just look at this, if we move ahead with this, that we not just look at these CDBG-eligible areas.
Mayor, Vice Mayor Walters, that was our game plan. This gives us a step, this gives us some place to start, but that we haven't done an analysis throughout the whole city which ones meet the existing standards or not. And there's also neighborhoods you mentioned that want lights, and there's some neighborhoods that don't want us in there, no lights at all. So it goes both ways, and we haven't done an analysis and taken a look at the whole city. It would take some time to do that, but this gives us an opportunity to start. If it gets approved, we can continue on and start looking at other areas, because there are other areas that are in the that fall outside these ones with red squares around them. So that was our game plan.
Okay, I appreciate that. And this isn't a matter of our trying to put lights in where people don't want lights. Rex Griswold used to joke with me that he would give me half of his street lights from Desert Uplands, and they would plant them over in West Mesa in places where people wanted them. So I think maybe he wasn't joking, but I think it's important to understand that these are people who are dealing with, and I don't want to make the neighborhood sound unsafe. They are not. But there is something about feeling safe, that it isn't just about being safe, it's also about feeling safe. And the lighting standards are not making them feel as safe as they would like to feel in their neighborhoods.
Okay, well, the issue for us today is to provide direction on whether we want street lighting included in the November 2008 potential bond election. So,
want a motion, Mayor?
Need a motion and probably the dollar amount, too, if you're ready.
Okay. Well, I'd like to make a motion that we include street lighting in the bond project. It's a five-year bond, so doing the math on this, I'm thinking about $12 million in the bond.
Okay, discussion? All right, is there a second first?
I have a question. For
all right, go ahead then.
I'm curious on which bonds. So we talk about the public safety bonds or the street bonds?
Street bonds. Sorry about that. In the street bonds.
I think that would be...
Lenny said, oh, shoot.
Sorry, Lenny. No, I think this belongs as a component of the street bond project, more in public safety. I understand that there are some public safety implications of that, but this is a street bond project, not a public safety, more directly a street bond project over public safety. Are we identifying specific projects right now other than this, or so we're just general overview? Are we going to have to identify specific projects before this goes to the vote, or we're just going to create this as a...
No, Mayor and Council, I think that we could have a dollar amount available, and then at the point that'd be up to the council, but my recommendation would be to wait until we get time. Each year, maybe there are a policy of trying to identify a priority list in the future that we can talk about. We're not prepared as staff today, certainly, to have that conversation about where the first streetlight should be placed in the city, because we really need to work with the council on kind of a policy direction of what is, what's most important in prioritization. I think today we're just trying to set an amount and an expectation of, what was it, if we 300 to 350 lights a year, I think that this would
300 and 350 poles a year.
Poles that this would allow us to do over a 5-year period.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I'll second Vice Mayor's motion then.
Okay. Under the discussion portion, I like the streets and the public safety, the light poles at $10 to $12 million feels just like we're adding on to a pretty solid request for funding and not knowing how to allocate. There's no one or two neighborhoods that are totally in distress, so it's going to be very hard to even indicate where those poles and lights are going to be placed to show any type of benefit to the residents. I'm not sure I want to put this item on with that election, especially not at a $10 or $12 million magnitude. I don't mind doing some street lighting and not using community development block grants, but to bond for existing neighborhoods to increase their level of lighting just doesn't, to me, rise to the high enough priority to want to put it on that bond election. So if I don't like $10 or $12 million because it seems like it's too much for street lighting to add, then do I want half of it? Well, then it's just it doesn't quite get me where I want to be either, because I don't want to put a little bit in just to placate or to have another something listed on the election. So that's what I'm struggling with right now. I'm not sure that it's a high enough priority in the overall scheme of things that I want to say, and street lighting needs to be part of this bond election, but we're not quite sure where they're going to go, and we're not quite sure which is the highest priority in the city, and there's a lot of places that would like them, but we don't know where to put them. I think there's too much confusion with that on, well, is that going to be a benefit to me or not? Well, maybe, but look at what we have throughout the whole city. I think some other comprehensive way of obtaining that, and I think Councilmember Truitt pointed out that as we do annexations, maybe we need more improvement districts and such so that they build their own streetlights, and it's not kind of subsidized over time by existing residents. So that's where I'm struggling with. I like the intent, and if we had were flush with cash, I would certainly love to do and update our street lighting, because I think the intent does improve some of the perception of safety. And I'm not, I could kind of go either way on this one, but I just am not quite sure that I want to cloud this election with that issue also being tacked onto it. So,
if I could, one of the issues that we could really probably enhance as a program, where today we do rusted poles and knockdowns based on maintenance, pretty much as we need them, scattered all over the city. This could turn into a more formatted program to draw efficiencies on doing a specific area. And while we're doing and replacing direct burial poles, if there's an opportunity the neighborhood wants, then we could redesign it such that we could meet a different standard. So from one perspective, it would give us some efficiencies in trying to take care of the whole issue of direct burial. They are rusting. As Lenny said, our people inspect those, and it's a pretty primitive way to inspect them, just a hammer test. But you can see that, and I think to a certain degree, we're doing the best we can, but we're probably underfunded, and that in and of itself is probably an issue. But if we had more dollars from an efficiency point of view, I think we'd be able to develop a program and do it in an orderly neighborhood manner. And then maybe at that point, there's an opportunity to talk to the neighborhood with reference to the standard and anything they want to do with reference to an SID, if that's the case, to enhance it.
Right. I guess my next question is one out of curiosity. Is it, are they rusted up like 3 or 4 foot high or 1 foot, or can't you sleeve them or put a solid piece of metal inside? If they're $6,500 a piece, you'd think there'd be some way to do a repair on them without having to do a total removal.
Good question, Mayor. We've done some testing. SRP has a company that goes in and does their poles, where they come in and apply an epoxy type material inside the pole. We tested some of them and been a little unsuccessful with it. Concerns because the way the wiring and all that stuff gets into our poles, it actually cements the wires in, so if the wire fails, now you got a pole, you got to take it out. So we had some troubles with that. It's not up 3 or 4 feet. It's typically ground level. When we talk about testing, we go out and actually clear out a little bit of soil around it, And this is what our pole manufacturers recommended, is apply a punch-like device, and if it goes through the pole in locations, then it's considered a pole that needs to be replaced. But we've tried different types of things. We tried doing concrete around them, and it's weak. There's also, in many cases, there's a handhole, places where you go and do the wiring, happens to be right in an area there, and that's kind of could be a weak point of the pole itself. So we've tried some things and really haven't been too happy with the end products.
So you can't tack weld back on a section and sleeve it?
I don't know how you would get in. Again, you have your wiring and things that get in. I mean, I don't know exactly what you'd weld to if you don't have a surface to weld to. I don't know. It goes down quite a distance down to into the pole itself.
Okay, I was just looking at the price of $6,500 a pole. It seems like a lot of it's got to be that. I mean, you're not taking out that much, and I'm not sure how many feet down you go. But
Mayor, one of the things that Beth pointed out in the meetings, we had discussions, when they talk $65 a pole, that's new conduit runs, that's everything with it. In a rusted pole, we don't spend that kind of money to replace a typical rusted or direct burial pole, because we're not doing rewiring in most cases. We're not putting new conduit runs or anything. It's taking a pole and putting a foundation. We're probably closer to $2,800 to $3,500 a pole. And we also recycle existing poles, too. So there is some advantages that we use when we take those poles out.
Okay. Well, I guess I made my comment, so let's go ahead. Vice Mayor.
Mayor, my concern is that while this is in the transportation street bond, my concern is public safety, and we have not identified any place in our budget where we can address these concerns. And in fact, apparently we haven't even projected using CDBG funds. We did have priorities under CDBG, and I raised the issue of you know, and now that's coming back to bite me, because we did have priorities under CDBG of which places needed it the most and where they needed it first. But I'm encountering neighborhoods that are saying, you know, how is the city helping us with our public safety? We have a problem with drug dealing going on out in front of our homes. It's an older part of the community. It's not a high-income part of the community, and there's not enough street lighting here, and so it invites activity that is negative activity, drug dealing and other kinds of things happening, and they feel that lights in the fronts of along the street would be a deterrent to that kind of activity, that shining light on it would cause the cockroaches to run back and go undercover. And so my question would be, what do you see as the methodology for addressing those neighborhoods that have those significant issues? And you know, if you would be more comfortable if we scaled back on the amount, I'm willing to look at that. But my concern is that we are then going to push off another 5 years addressing these very real public safety issues. And the reason I'm hesitating to name neighborhoods is because, you know, you don't want to put a label on a neighborhood that says, wow, there's a neighborhood where crime is happening. That's a negative neighborhood. These are neighborhoods where the neighbors care. Now, does every neighborhood in that neighborhood care? No. But you have a core of people who are trying to address criminal activity that's occurring in their area, and they're looking to the city to partner with them to try and do that. They are putting things on their own homes, you know, lighting their own particular area, but they're saying that the city needs to light the street.
And I guess if I was to put money in an area, it would be code compliance. That's probably the area I'd tackle before I do street lighting. But I'm certainly not opposed to street lighting. I just don't know if it warrants being placed in the bond election, is my comment. And if I don't like $12 million and I compromise for $5 million, it's still kind of the principle of, am I really in favor of a little but not quite getting it done right? Or so I struggle with, you know, working down to another dollar figure, although I probably could do that. But let's hear some other comments on this one. Go ahead, Scott.
I don't really have an issue with putting this on the bond project. It's a capital project. I also don't have an issue with trying to identify specific neighborhoods. And the reason being, when you look at these maps, particularly the direct buried poles, when you look at the CDBG Street Light Improvement Program prioritization map, this is citywide. There are priorities in every district. And while your neighborhood may not benefit directly, your neighborhood certainly will benefit indirectly from improvements in some of these CDBG areas, the struggling areas to the north of you or nearby. So as we improve these neighborhoods, as we improve indirectly the safety of these neighborhoods, then you know, rising tide raises all ships, if you will. They're looking at some of these pictures on the spot improvements on these poles. And these things are going to come down at some point. We're going to have to pay money at some point. It's cheaper to do it today than to wait another 5 years or to wait to, God forbid, one of these poles falls on the neighbor's car. And then instead of the car paying for the pole's paying for the car because the thing just fell over. So having some flexibility in this, I think it's easy to look at a map and say, all right, we're going to pay $12 million for pole improvements or replacements. We can see where these neighborhoods are going to be. We can see where the direct bury poles are. And having the flexibility to identify the more severe areas with the $12 million makes good sense to me because we'll address the major problems first. But also, you know where that money's going to go. It's $12 million going specifically to lighting neighborhoods and replacing the deteriorating infrastructure of some of that lighting in neighborhoods. It's not some money that can go to any old project. This is where it's going to go, and it's very likely to affect a little bit of every city. The flexibility also allows us to do what Councilmember Truitt brought up, is to look at these areas and say, what areas has the city historically been paying for these poles? Where have they been? Where are they falling apart? And what parts of the city were developed to a county standard and came in later, and maybe we treat those a little bit differently. So in this particular case, I do like the flexibility. Thank you, Mayor.
Councilmember Truitt, what's your position on this one?
I've really got two or three things, I guess. One is there was some discussion, should this be public safety or transportation? And we immediately jumped to transportation. And yet all the examples we're giving primarily is public safety. I'd like to see some statistics that shows me that we're having accidents or things involving vehicles having a lot to do with streetlights. And you could probably find one or two isolated incidents. But I really think that this is a much more public safety issue, not a transportation issue. And I think we're trying to fool ourselves by calling these transportation needs and putting them on the transportation bond versus a public safety bond. We've talked about deterrence to crime. So are police officers, so are police cars, so are all these other things that are in the public safety bond. The second was that I think if we were to want to call these transportation items, then I don't know why we're not bringing this to the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and having a discussion there maybe in a little more depth, as opposed to bringing it up now as part of the bond election. And then my third point would be, I'm still going back to this idea of having the neighborhoods help pay for it. At $6,500 a pole, that's about $37 a foot. And you're going to split that between two sides of the street, so you're down to maybe $20 a foot, maybe with ID costs up to $25 a foot. And if the city paid half of it and let these people leverage it, you're down to $12 or $13 a foot for a 60-foot wide lot, less than $1,000 over 20 years. It's $50 a year, $4 a month. I just think they can do that. And I just think we should be looking at more creative ways to leverage our money and encourage people to participate in upgrading their neighborhoods to make them safer neighborhoods and to bring them to standards that are today's standards. These people never paid for these streetlights, whether they were in the city or outside the city. They either paid for streetlights that are at a much lower standard than other neighborhoods today, or they didn't pay for them at all. So anyway, that's my points.
Okay. Scott?
I just wanted to respond to Darrell. Darrell, I'm pretty much the one that's insisting on trying to put this in the street bond. I think there are public safety. I know there are public safety implications to having lighting in neighborhoods, most of those have to do with crime, and some of those have to do with motor vehicle accidents. But we don't look to the police department budget or the fire department budget for the installation of streetlights. That's part of the transportation department's budget. So it just seems to me that this is 70-80% transportation. That's where the budget comes from, and that's where the sort of be funded out of is the transportation bond. I don't know that we need to go through the tick. Your last point too, which right now I'm blanking on. I'm sorry, I didn't get a whole lot of sleep last night. Anyway, so I'll stop there for a moment until it comes back to me. But that's why I wanted this in the streets bond package.
Kyle.
And I don't have any heartburn over which package it is. I just think we need to address it. And part of what Councilmember Truitt was talking about of leveraging and getting neighborhoods involved, I'm very open to doing that. But if you don't have any money available for participation, it's a mute subject anyway. We don't have money to even participate if neighborhoods want to do it. So I still think we need to put some money in where we are able to allow for that improvement. And we don't obviously have much of that option in the general budgeting. That's why we're looking at the bond for a capital project.
Scott?
Thanks again, Mayor. I remembered. It just takes a minute. The other part, Darrell, was what you brought up, and I agree with you, where we have maybe the special assessment district will work in some areas. There's a combination of areas here looking at these little red dots. Some of these areas were built in the city, but were built to standards in 1960 or 70. And so that infrastructure was built to current standards at the time, and that infrastructure is starting to fail. And there's a place where this flexibility will say, well, it was built in Mesa, it's deteriorating, now we need to bring it up to standards. We have some other areas, quite frankly, in our district, yours and mine, that were built in the county and then annexed in, and that's an area where we say, well, we'll help leverage some dollars, but really you were built to county standards, and if you want to leverage some dollars, maybe a special improvement district where we split it. But that's where some of this flexibility comes in. Rather than identifying specific areas for projects, we have the opportunity over time to look at the different areas, the reasons where this was developed, and implement different programs, but at least we'll have the capital dollars with voter approval to tackle some of these projects and take care of some of these problems. Thanks, Mayor.
Okay. Mayor, just a point. I just want to clarify, and maybe it's more intent than functionality, but there are streetlights in the current proposed bond election because they are part of, in many cases, part of street improvements that are being contemplated today. I know that's maybe not quite the conversation, but I just want to be clear that there are streetlights existing as part of the package of road improvements.
Okay, Tom, you've been silent. You want to weigh in on this one, too?
I might suggest, for sake of convenience and the inability or the difficulty in bringing things back for reconsideration, that we postpone this until there's seven of us here.
Council Member Whalen is absent, but I think we really have six, so if we need to get to four on a vote. I don't think we're going to get there.
I don't believe so.
All right. All right, somebody's done. All right.
What I'm saying is that other people on this council have given me the courtesy before of not pushing things to a vote when they're going to be tied or lost, and so I'm trying to do the same thing here.
Okay. Well, we have a motion and a second, though, on the floor for...
I'll withdraw my motion.
All right. I said I would withdraw my second.
Okay. It sounds like we need a little bit more discussion and work on this one. There is, a real timing issue, I believe, on this.
Yeah. Can I suggest that this come to the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee meeting next Thursday?
Is there one scheduled already on Thursday?
There is, Mayor, however, that we could. It's mm-hmm. a very full agenda, by the way, and I don't oppose that, although my only concern is that we had anticipated putting this on the Monday, December 17th council, am I saying that right? 17th council agenda? Mm-hmm. So that would be the Thursday preceding. The other option would be to bring in for the full council in the study session of the 13th, and then then a decision, then we could get direction out. If we put on the committee, that doesn't have the full council, so then I'm not sure what the comfort of the council is. Just.
Yeah. Vice Mayor.
Yeah, and these are not, these aren't issues of technicalities. These are issues of philosophy that we're discussing. So I don't see how sending it to the TIC is going to resolve the philosophical issue. And because of the timing, I mean, normally that would be the way to go, but because of the timing, I don't think we can sequence it.
Tom?
Basically, what we're doing on the 17th is voting on the size of the package. And I'm stopped by ordinance, so we don't have to introduce it ahead of time. So we get to the meeting on the 17th. If there's four votes to add $12 million, then we do it. If there isn't four votes, we don't do it, and we pass it on the 17th. We just need one more meeting with one more council member.
Right.
Okay, so I don't think it's as complicated.
Okay. Scott?
I have nothing else on this one, but I do have a question on the public safety bonds when we're done with this conversation.
All right.
Under this agenda item, that should be fine.
It is on the agenda item, yes. We'll move up.
At the mayor's discretion.
Item one.
Yeah. As the streets people run away.
Okay. The way this is written, I guess projects included in the anticipated, including streetlights. So go ahead. What's your question?
My question is, and if we have somebody from the fire department here, I have a question related to the fire bonds. We have two fire stations being rebuilt. We have three stations being proposed. In no particular order. We'll start with that. Which ones are the stations being proposed? I was looking at the summary last night, and it didn't say anything overly specific. Do we have three specific locations where those stations are going to be? And then I'll hit you with my real question after that. This is a setup.
I understand it. Councilmember Summers, Mayor Hawker, we do have three new fire stations in the bond package and two rebuilds. The three fire stations that will be new will be basically 8th Street and Alma School as a start. That was the final Engine 218, which is funded by Quality of Life, which is the final Quality of Life fire station. And the land is purchased there. The second site that we're looking at, again, and no definite particular order, is the 56th and Main area. If you look at the fire department response map and our station planning area, we've got open area there that needs a fire station.
Do we also have that land? Do we have that land?
We do not own that parcel of property to date.
Okay, so we, and another piece of that particular bond is the purchase of four parcels for future fire stations, correct?
Yes, in that bond package, there's about $4 million for the additional purchase of fire station properties.
Would that include this piece, or is this piece included in the new construction of three new firehouses?
That would be the construction of the property purchase at 56 and Main would come out of that property purchase fund in the bond package.
Okay.
The other area that is very important to us in the development down in the Gateway development area is be Site 3 that you see on the fire station planning map. That station right now, that area doesn't have a high call volume, but it's certainly one of our fastest growing areas of the city. So, and geographically, we have very long response down in that area. So those are the three areas. And of course, the rebuilds are Station 215, which is the Gateway fire station. It's a 1950s military fire station. It also, there's a push to move that fire station to make room for the terminal and the passenger service out there. And then, of course, the rebuild of Station 203 at Site 4.
Here's where I'm going to, this is the trap. There's a fire station location that's been identified for quite some time on Broadway between Crisman and Signal Butte. About
104th and Broadway.
There's a sign that's been there forever and a day that says new fire station coming. I think the last sign said 2010. This bond goes to 2013. That fire station is not on this bond. Out of curiosity, why not?
If we look at the response needs citywide, and we look at the way we space fire stations geographically as well as for call volume, the site at 104th and Broadway doesn't create the high priority. Our number one priority over in West Mesa with stations 218 and 203, station 203 currently has a call volume of 4,000 plus calls per unit. If we go to the 56 in Main area, right around station 5 predominantly covers that area, and engine 205 and engine 2205 currently running over 3,000 calls apiece. If we look at the 104th and Broadway, it certainly is a site where we need a fire station. Geographically, the map shows that it's a priority for a fire station there. But our call volume out of station 217 is running right around 1,700 calls a month.
A year. 1,700 a month. I'm getting my firehouse. No wonder you're so tired. That's why I'm so tired. I don't even work out of that firehouse, and I'm tired because of that.
I may have played right into your program here. Anyway, 1,700 calls a year. So we do need a fire station there. It's identified. The property is purchased. It is not one of the top four simply because of the call volume. But it doesn't mean we don't need a fire station there. We'd love to have the opportunity to put a fire station there.
Call volume is one measure of need, but response time is the other. You had mentioned with 218, the problem is just volume of calls. We have a tremendous volume of calls. That's where the population is, and it's hard to keep up with those with that call volume. Over on Elliott and Mountain, the problem isn't call volume. The problem is response time. It's over 10 minutes. My concern on 104th and Broadway is twofold. Most of that, what is the response time over to this area as we begin continue to annex it, but also we have a lot of this area filled in, and it seems to me the closest firehouse is south of US 60 a ways down toward baseline. So what is our response time, particularly up to some of these, well, here's a flip, city islands that we own between Brown and University. Yeah, it's usually a county island. Now we have city islands. Brown and University plus all this new growth area, and is this something we should be looking at trying to tag toward the end of this bond? Because we already own that property. We've identified it for a fire station for some time. The sign has been up there. I've gotten questions on this before, and now we're saying, well, even in 2013, you're not going to have your firehouse. And this is a very specific, this is a public safety issue. It's very specific. We already own the land, and there's a lot of land out here and long response times, and I'm wondering if this is something we should also consider adding to if we're going to add for streetlights. And
well, Mayor, Councilman Summers, Gary, or is it Chuck, who has the numbers for a fire station at this location? Do we have that number?
Okay, it depends, the cost on the capital side depends on where you drop it in the programming. Let's say we built it in 12-13, it's about 5.6 on the capital side. 13-14, it's another 200,000, 5.8 million. Now, the more significant issue to us is the operating side. So if we use the same programming, we're talking about 1.7 million out into the future on an added fire station per year.
Well, we're going to incur that cost somewhere, and I don't mind putting this off toward the end of this bond, but we need a fire station out here, and I think by the time we get to 2013, between annexations and growth, and the last area of growth is in this area, we are assessing impact fees for this. Those monies can roll into that. We need four new firehouses now. These would be those four new firehouses, and then with the area to the south, we're going to have to concentrate on being GM proving ground. We can look at some other alternative methods of raising some capital for those as those come in. But that's going to be 5-6 years out, I assume. I don't know where to go with the conversation with this, other than I would like to see this fire station.
Mayor, Council Summers, I think the staff would concur that we need more fire stations. I think the limitation of the numbers that were included was really just trying to create a balance on the fiscal impact. Certainly, out into 5 years into the future, if the bonds are approved with a secondary property tax, we'll be able to build a capital, build a facility. It'll really be up to councils in the future about determining how those operating costs will be determined. And obviously, they'll want to have that in place to rebuild it. But your point's well taken. And I think it's just up to this council if we want to add another $5.8 million into the $400 million bond package we have today. I mean, that's just really a decision of the council. I don't materially, as far as the overall impact on the secondary tax rate, I'm not sure what is the pennies on that one.
Well, on the operating side, what we're talking about now is just under 8 cents on average on that rate. So if you add another 1.7, you're talking in what, another 3 cents maybe?
So that's, but certainly, I mean, the staff is certainly in favor of continuing to at least have a plan in place and have the funding in the future available for those opportunity. I think that's part of what this bond package does, is it allows us to address some needs into the future. Obviously, we're going to have to do it in a manner in which not only, if we have a capital, is how would we fund the operation side, but having the ability to do that and knowing that it will be paid for with a secondary property tax makes the opportunities more likely. And we know we're going to be adding more fire stations even after this five-year program too, so there's still more needs throughout the city, but putting at the end of the program and adding this bond package, I mean, I think the staff would certainly support that.
Right, and beyond this package, again, I think many of those stations are going to be added in this in my district, and I'm looking forward to some different mechanisms that will help fund those, whatever those might be, and that would really help that particular growth pay for itself. This would be one example, and I think I'm getting some head nods over here that I think I'd be supported on that as well. But this is an existing neighborhood with the existing needs, and it's been identified, and we already own the land. We know the need is there, maybe not right now based on call volume, but based on response time, and I would like to see that added. Yeah, and certainly within 5 years, that need is going to increase, and I would like to see that added to this particular bond package so we have that infrastructure in place, or at least a plan in place to start adding that.
Is this in year five of the bond?
That was the number, yes, Mayor.
So it's $5 or $6 million capital and $1.7 million operations?
That's correct.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
I concur with Councilmember Summers on this one. I think that by not including it in here, we close the door on the option of doing it. And I really see that area just, you know, needing services that we don't have out there. And so I'm concerned about not allowing for it to happen. And what we're really saying is if we don't include it, even out in year five, that it's going to be another, you know, then you have to go through that whole cycle all over again. You go out and you're looking at really probably 7 years before you could look at doing that. So I actually Scott, I concur with you.
On the public safety of the fire station, to have it in the ability to issue the bonds, I mean, this just gives the voter approval. It would be up to the council and the constraints that they face at the time. So this one I'm actually in favor of doing. Kyle?
Well, it includes also ramifications when we present the whole bond package. You have an area out there where they've been promised a station, the sign's been up, the expectation has been there. And then if here we throw a bond package out and it's not included in that bond package, we've been fighting hard to gain public trust and to follow through on what has been presented. And if we don't follow through on it, there's a credibility issue, and we have a tremendous problem, again, when it comes to presenting something to the voters, and they're going to say, can we trust you? And that is a very strong element when you go with something like this, where that sign has been up for considerable time and the expectation has been there. I think we need to follow through with that fire station. it is definitely a public safety issue because of the time. It doesn't have the call volume out in that area, but the time of response, which is the most critical aspect, is we need to have that station there. And you, I know you know we need it. It's just the fiscal challenge that comes with it, but it needs to be included so we have that option.
Yeah, and I understand the response time and call volume, and I'm sure there's a matrix as far as most efficient deployment of resources, and I look to the fire department to make that call and to give us feedback on it. I appreciate Scott's expertise being a firefighter himself, so but I'm not saying that because we put up a sign and we thought we were going to have one, we analyze that at the date that with the most current data. So if we wait 4 years and it hasn't changed, I'm not sure if I was on that council, I'd vote to build that station. But I think we do need to be responsible enough to have the money in the bond program that we could, if in fact the information dictated that it was a high priority and that's the best spot in Mesa to do it. Might be that there's a lot of infill development and we need another double up station on the east side or something else by that time. So I'm not trying to say specifically let's just plan them today with the data we have and say that they can we guarantee the station will be built. I still think we need to use the best data available as the time progresses and we get closer to that date when that analysis needs to take place. So I don't mind having the sign up there and say, well, but the circumstances changed, we're not building it. I'll face that one.
But at least they have the option.
Yeah, I would agree with the option, and that's why I would say put the capital in, but put it in on year five so that otherwise the model, the operations just throw you for a loop. To try to staff it, and it's just be very difficult to do. And then that council at that time will have to make that decision whether they have the operations money primarily, because you can bond the capital. And then that $1.7 million continues forever. That's the difficulty. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Other discussion on this one?
Just direction.
Direction at this time? Or?
What direction you want to
move? I think I hear the council. Mayor, are we resolved this issue?
Well, Councilmember Truitt, did you want to weigh in on this one on the fire station?
No, I have nothing to add.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mayor, can we just go back to the previous item, only because I just want to be clear, are we going to bring the item on the streetlights back to the full council on a Thursday, or you want to just have the discussion as part of the item that we on the posted on the Monday council meeting where we're calling the election? What's the preference?
I don't
council?
Think it makes any difference.
If we can do it on that Thursday before,
sure.
That council is okay with that.
Bring
okay.
it back to the full
Thank
council.
You. I just want to get that clear. Okay. Thank you.
Right.
And again, the purpose is really trying to get a list of projects out there and amount so the public can start, we can start educating the public and getting a discussion going about that. I don't believe ultimately council can modify this package. You know, probably any time up until the last date you can call the election in July. But we are really trying to get a package fairly solidified so we can really start talking about it. So
it would be helpful for me if I was going to be swayed towards doing streetlights to know what the priority is and where would that money be spent in a map, not showing all of the buried ones, but where would the department recommend that $2.5 million be spent per year and have maps for the next 5 years on where those pole replacements would be anticipated.
Okay.
That would be more meaningful if I was going to go, that there was some type of a plan layout and that was fairly well defined. Now, maybe they're still reappearing and they don't know. But
I think we can certainly do that, Mayor, and we give it an attempt. I feel a little awkward doing that absent some more broader policy direction from the council, but let us give it a shot, and maybe that is a discussion that the TIC can start, or we can go back to the TIC with, or something like that. But we can certainly start that and come up with at least our best efforts on that initially, and at least start to the discussion. And I hear what you're saying is just a little more definition of how we're going to use them in the future, if that's where we go.
Sure.
I agree. We can work on that.
All right. Anything else on item number one on our study session? Right. Let's go to two, which is hear a presentation discussing to provide direction on the approval process for liquor license applications.
Mayor and Council. My name is Jenny Shepherd, the Financial Service Operations Director, and I have with me Tim Myers, who is our licensing administrator. A couple of council meetings back, we had an application for a bar and wine store license, and we changed the process in which we approved the license, and you asked us to come back to you with kind of an overview of what process we use, and so we could get your direction if there needed to be any additional changes.
I think we were told at the time that we were somewhat following Phoenix's lead, that Phoenix had already done that for liquor license.
Yes, the applicant brought us the information from Phoenix.
All right.
And as you all know, the liquor license process starts with an application that's received from the state of Arizona. The state of Arizona sends that license application to the city, and where we get with the applicant and tell them the city process that they need to follow. I just listed here a few of the common liquor licenses that you see on the agendas. There's 17 different series, but these are the most common. Once we get that application from the state of Arizona, we have 60 days in which we have to get back to the state with either the council's recommendation for denial or approval of this license. We go out and we do the posting, and I think there was some question on what the sign, the notice looks like. The sign that we get from the state of Arizona, they actually provide it to us, is that size. The board that they post it on is 2x3, but the notice is relatively small. Councilmember Truitt mentioned a larger green sign, which Mason doesn't use at the time. We got with our print shop. The city of Phoenix actually uses a big green sign, such as this, that we had printed up. And we certainly can use this for new construction sites. It costs the city about $10 additional to have this sign. But we only have a very few new construction sites, so we certainly could use this if you wish.
I think it was kind of a unanimous echo up here on why would it cost the city the $10?
We could add it to the fee for the scheduled fees and charges this coming spring.
I think you have concurrence with that. Tom?
The state has mandated and provides a sign for us, and that doesn't cost the applicant anything else.
That's correct.
We're making the decision that we want to have a bigger green one, but we're going to make the applicant pay for it, so you don't have unanimous concurrence.
Okay. I could certainly ask the state to go back and say, hey, why don't you make a bigger sign and have them pay for it up front so that there's not a duplication. They must have in their licensing program whatever it costs to apply for the state license, that allocation for signage, if they're going to give it to them. So maybe some joint cooperation would certainly be worthwhile. Vice Mayor.
Mayor, the difference is that the sign that the state is providing currently, we use those on, we use them on locations where, and you're intending to use it in the future on locations where it's an existing business, it goes like on the door or something like that. What you're talking about using the green sign for, if I understood correctly, is a vacant parcel like we had come forward to us at Southern and Stapley that wants to now have a liquor license in addition to, they're doing construction and everything. So it's sitting out there in the middle of a field with a big 3-foot thing with this little tiny sign on it. And so I don't have a problem with it because they're asking for something different than the process that we have done in the past. This is granting a liquor license before the construction of the thing, and so I view it differently.
Once we receive that application, our office, once we put the notice out, sends the information to several different departments to see if there's any concerns with those departments, such as zoning. With our bar license, they have to be in certain zoning. They can't be in a C2 zone unless they have a council use permit. The police department does the background check, and we send it also to building safety and our credit services for them to look at their records to see if there's any issues. We also send it to fire prevention, and of the three situations might exist for existing occupancies, and that would be a change in ownership. They go out to the restaurant and do an inspection. We have had issues with new owners putting in new stoves and ovens and that type of equipment and not getting the correct building permits, and so they go out to each of those sites and check for those types of code violations. Then there's a permanent extension of the premise, which might be where they spill out into a patio area. The liquor license is specifically for in the establishment, inside, and they need to get a special release from the state and the city to spread out the premises for that patio area. And again, the fire department would go out and do a check to make sure there was fencing, proper fencing in that, around that area. The area that we've had the concern with is new construction, that, as you heard from Mr. Nations, some of his clients are coming in, and before they spend the money to do the permits and engineering and all that, they would like assurance that they could get their liquor license. And so they've asked that we waive our requirement to have the certificate of occupancy and the building permits prior to this council recommending to the state their approval of their liquor license. So previously we did require that. We have had a few establishments that have had to pull their liquor license application with the state to wait to get their submittal to the city. But now our recommendation is that if there aren't any other issues besides that they'd have not submitted their building for their building permit, that we go ahead and recommend approval of the liquor license. This is where the affidavit, suggestion of the affidavit that Phoenix is now using. Tim did a little research with the other cities, and he'll give you an update of what the other cities. We found that the city of Phoenix is actually the only city that uses an affidavit. We had our city attorney's office draft an affidavit, but at this point we really don't feel, from talking to our fire prevention and our building safety in our attorney's office, that we need an additional affidavit signed by the applicant, but certainly if you wish and at your direction, we could use that.
And currently right now, the cities that we went out and asked their processes were Chandler, Tempe, Scottsdale, Phoenix, and Glendale. And the only two cities that are not requiring or not looking at building permits for new construction is Scottsdale. Right now, they don't. If the applicant has not taken out their permits in Scottsdale for new construction, they'll still recommend an approval in Scottsdale. All the other cities are requiring them to currently have their permits at least started or completed. Tempe's the only one right now that will allow or will recommend an approval if the permits have been taken out but have not been completed yet. All the other cities are requiring them right now to have their permits completed, other than Phoenix, as we know now, has now started that new process where they'll do the affidavit if they do not have their permits completed. And on existing buildings, all of the cities are looking at the permits being completed. So right now, I think basically Mr. Nations and this recommendation is really going forward for the affidavits on new construction only. And right now, like I said, the Scottsdale is the only one right now that is not concerned with the building permits being taken out or being completed. They feel that there's enough in their codes as well that if the C of O is not completed, they'll go and shut the business down if it's not handled that way. So they're not using the liquor process to enhance that.
And a liquor license application is different than a zoning, which goes with the land. The liquor actually goes with the applicant. So if there was something that during construction took place and they sold it, then there would need to be a new application.
There would be a new application, and the review would be on the applicant, on the person, not the location.
Okay. All right. I like the process. I'm not sure what, maybe I can ask from the legal standpoint whether that affidavit is needed or not, what the recommendation is from our city attorney.
Mayor, Council, Jack Schaefer from my office took a look at that, and so I'll ask him to respond to that question.
Okay.
Good morning, Mayor Hawker. Based on conversations with staff, including building safety and fire, the staff's recommendation is that an affidavit is not legally required for the city to enforce its certificate of occupancy process. If council wishes us to go with an affidavit, a draft document has been prepared, and as drafted, we believe it would provide additional assurances for the city. However, it would not be needed.
I'd say let's don't do it then. If we have the other checks and balances, why bother? Would be my take on it, at least. Scott?
I'm just curious as to why these new buildings seem to feel that they need a different set of rules here. Are there cases in Arizona that you're aware of, looking just generally over here, where the building was constructed, planned for, constructed, received a certificate of occupancy, but then the liquor license was denied by the state? I mean, why are they coming forward all of a sudden saying we need a different rule here? Or is it a loan issue where their financing isn't being backed without the liquor license being in place?
No, Councilmember Summers, my understanding is the concern of the applicant is on the petition process, the 20-day notice, and they want to get that done ahead of time so that they know if they're going to have any neighborhood opposition to that license at that location. If there is, then they want to deal with that before they go ahead and spend the money on their permits.
That makes sense. Okay.
So
I'm going to concur, actually, that unless this is have any additional force and effect under law that we even need, or is it just another piece of paper? Mayor, Councilmember Summers, it contains the language that's in ARS Title 13 that talks about statements made under oath, but other than that, it really does not provide any additional enforcement assurances.
But there are civil and or criminal penalties under the Mesa City Code for operating without a certificate of occupancy.
That is correct. Those are already contained in the city code at Title 4.
I'm good. I'm satisfied with that.
Okay. What do we have here?
I just listed some of the criteria that the council actually can use to determine whether they're going to approve a liquor license or not. We really don't need to go through that if you don't care to.
So I think what I hear is somewhat in concurrence is going along the same way with Phoenix has, so that you can apply for a vacant parcel, don't have to have the building permits or construction documents in place prior to filing for the liquor license application. And we do not need a notarized statement here, an affidavit. So I think just the only thing that maybe we need some discussion on is the signage, whether there's some disagreement or not on that. I think that if you're going to, especially if you're going to do it on a vacant parcel, I think the larger signage would be more necessary, and I think we're more into the who pays for it. But I think it's a little bit similar to a zoning case where neighborhood involvement, and we did make a stipulation for the size of the zoning case sign so that they're on a vacant parcel, have some visibility. And I don't think there's much difference on a liquor license application, personally. Tom?
On that issue, it seems to me that I'm worried about a little bit of a preemption issue here. If the state has basically said that sign is adequate for all liquor license applications. Have they said that? Or
No.
And they're the ones who've given it. They give it to us, so I'm assuming they've passed judgment on it somehow.
We, Councilmember Rawls, we did contact the state. The city of Phoenix uses their own large green sign.
Right.
They have no issues with us posting
okay.
a larger sign or a different color sign as long as the verbiage is the same as this
Okay, so they've mandated the verbiage, but not the size or the color or that kind of stuff?
That's right.
And then I'm not as concerned. Let me ask another question. Do we have liquor license applicants come to us? Do they have to pay a fee to us as well as to the state?
That's correct.
Okay, and where, and each jurisdiction has the discretion to set that fee at whatever level they feel to cover their staff involvement, et cetera?
That's right.
Okay, and I was thinking that it was more of a locked-in thing, so I'm not concerned about adding a $10 if that's what it, I don't want us paying for the bigger sign.
Okay.
So I'll retract my prior opposition.
All right. Kyle?
As far as the sign goes, with the electronic capabilities we have now, can't we just dictate, you've got to post a sign such a size, here it is electronically, you go print it, put it up, and we make sure it's there? Or do we want to just put it in a fee? I mean, all we just need to require that they have a sign of a certain size and color posted so that people recognize it's for a liquor license. But we could just give them the electronic meeting and say, here it is, you go put it on a sign. We don't need to print it, do we?
I don't.
Actually, I don't know this for an absolute fact, but I believe the state requires us to put the sign out. I think that's a requirement on our side. So, and again, for the $10, I'd feel more comfortable making sure our sign's put up so we got the verbiage exactly the way it's supposed to be, because they are very picky about that verbiage being exact.
We have to go out, and in addition to this notice, we have to post the actual application, a copy of the application, also on that posting board.
All right. So one question then. When we're doing building, you know, for zoning hearings, all that stuff, who puts the signs up on all those kinds of things?
Mayor, Council, Member Jones, that is the applicant, and they provide us with pictures and affidavit that they have done that posting, that they do it.
That's the line that I was thinking. We require them to put a sign up of a certain size and have the requirement, and let them bear all the expense of putting it up. And we just dictate what it is. And I'd say with electronic media, we could say, here's what's on it. Here's the electronic file. You go to a printer and have them produce what you need.
Did I hear you say, though, that the city is required to put up the liquor license sign?
I'm not positive about that. I need to check. It is a duty that we've taken on, and they expect us to have the sign up. So I'm not sure if they'd be satisfied that we would just go and check and verify that the sign is up. The sign just needs to be posted for 20 days, and they've asked that we place those signs out there. I don't know if that's a requirement or just a request.
And we can check into that. Yes. We do have to go out and post the application, but we'll check with the state on that.
Post it when you go to verify they put their sign up.
Sure, we can do that.
And I'm thinking, if it's vacant land, we have a zoning case sign that we've outlined. Why wouldn't the liquor license application be similar in size?
They are required to put up the posting board at their own expense. It's just the notice that the city posts.
It gets attached to the posting board?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Seems like there's some duplication there. I'll go out and put this up and give you a call, and you can slap your sign on top.
We'll check.
Okay, please. I think there's a better streamline
method
for that. Yeah. Okay. All right. I think any other direction needed on this one?
No.
Okay. Number three is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on modem one, use classifications and use regulations of the zoning code update.
Mayor and Council, as Gordon's getting up here, getting situated to give a full presentation on this, there's a related topic that I want to take a moment and discuss with the council. Since the major general plan amendment last year with the Levine property, there's been some discussion and idea floating of the potential of a freeway land use designation or a freeway zoning designation. And so in terms of the zoning code, this would maybe be an opportunity to bring that up. We have looked at that around the valley and around the country. We find no examples of anybody using freeway land use designation or freeway zoning. If we were to create a freeway zoning district and put it in our code, we could do that, and it would allow a person to build a freeway then on the property that's so zoned. I'm not sure what other uses it would allow besides that. And we have a hard time imagining somebody voluntarily zoning their property to a freeway zoning designation.
We have one.
Maybe. I mean, it did come up and with the Levine property, and they talked about from the general plan perspective designating a freeway land use designation. If we start with that and do just a general plan designation of a freeway, you can still build whatever the zoning that's on the property allows, And so you have the freeway designation, but it's zoned R143 or C2 or whatever zoned. You could still build according to the zoning district. So you'd really have to have, go that second step and have the zoning district. And then an applicant would need to zone the property. With Prop 207 issues, we wouldn't want to go out and impose a zoning district on somebody that didn't want to. So we could do that. The applicability seems pretty limited. And again, we haven't seen any other examples of it. So just want to go ahead and mention that to the council as we continue to talk about the zoning code and what districts we might have in the different portions of the code.
I mean, because this is something that I've been pushing for since I've worked on the alignment and the probably enhance their property dramatically by having the freeway cut through it as opposed to the higher up on the GM property. And we had some discussions with Queen Creek and other cities wanting the different alignment, and I really wanted it to go through Mesa. And they agreed on the zoning that they were not trying to enhance the land further by saying that, well, it was commercially zoned, so our right-of-way cost should be higher. They understand that they've enhanced their other property. It's a freeway. It's the basically the land value, and I wish we could have locked them in for what they paid for it, because I think they probably would have agreed at the time to do that. So I want something, or I'm looking for something that says it is not anything that's entitled for higher and better use other than the designated freeway that's been agreed upon. And it may be unique to this area, but I'm trying to hold down the land acquisition cost with agreement from the landowner. They agree to do this designation, so it's not a forced designation on them. And I appreciate them doing that, you know, and working cooperatively with the city of Mesa. So that's the intent. And if we have to talk to the landowner to say how to accomplish this, that's fine with me. But I am really looking for some type of designation on that freeway right-of-way corridor so that it doesn't come back in as a industrial or a high-rise building could have been sited there, and this is our value for the land, because I think we're already past that aspect of it. So that's the intent. So how you get there, I don't really care, but I really am looking for some way to, and maybe it's not through this process at all. Maybe it's through an agreement that is signed saying what our understanding is for the right-of-way purchase value or something. But we have a landowner that's been very cooperative in working with the freeway alignment and in this area, and I think has a pretty good deal going for himself that is also understands that a lot of that is because that freeway was fought for by the city of Mesa to go in that location. So that's the intent.
Great. All right. Road board.
Okay.
Mayor, council members, what you have before you today is the discussion item to talk about what we're calling Module 1, which are the use regulations and the use classification. This is part of the zoning ordinance project that's been kind of ongoing for the last year or so. We've been doing quite a bit of research related to that, related to the general plan, related to the existing zoning ordinance, related to some of the existing council policies that have gone on. What we'll talk about is the progress to date, some, the overview of what Module 1 is trying to do, some of the summary of the recommended changes, as well as discuss some questions that we've tried to, so we can get a little bit further direction on to where to go from this point forward. The work that's been done to date, there's been four reports that have been issued, one that had to do with stakeholders that we called the Code Users Interviews and Summary Report. We did a community workshop, and we issued a report for that. There's an Issues and Options working paper. We brought that to the council in June and had a very, I think, helpful discussion there. There's also an outline that's been done. We haven't presented that to anybody yet, but it basically what it does is provide an organizational structure for how the ordinance will be done in the future. It doesn't really have any substantive value other than we know where things are going to be slotted. Today, what we'd like to talk about specifically is Module 1. One of the things that you'll see in terms of the use regulations, and this is probably the major change to, in terms of, is the format of the code. The current zoning ordinance is basically a list of zoning districts, and then within each of those zoning districts, you have a list of uses that are permitted within there. Zoning ordinance primarily regulates land uses. What we're proposing with the update is to go to a table format or a matrix format. And this is, the idea is to try to get as much information as possible to the user of the zoning ordinance on one page, and then let them know where to reference that relatively quickly. This has got basically two major reasons to do this. One is, again, it makes it fairly easy to see, okay, this is permitted in this district. You can compare these things side by side. But in addition to that, what it does is it helps us long term, because it helps us to computerize the zoning ordinance and make it easier for folks that way, because then we can hypertext all those links and make it easier for people to research the zoning ordinance through computer later on in the future. The other aspects of this that we're looking at include what we're calling a classification system. Basically, instead of every single little land use being proposed, we're going to a classification system. We're going to use the existing methodology for in terms of authorizing the land use. We've got permitted uses, or what we're calling by right uses. We have council use permits, special use permits. We're also adding something called a limited use, which is, rather than having to go through a public hearing process, if we already established what the standards are for that, as long as they meet the standards, then they're allowed to do that. So it's kind of, it's not quite a by right use, but it's not quite a use permit. It's something kind of in between, as well as some regulations and some cross-references. We think there are obviously several advantages to this, including side-by-side comparison, and you don't need to flip around the code quite as much. Again, just a real quick example of what the table format would look like, where you can see the alphabetical list of the use. You can look across, you can see if something's permitted, there's a P. If something's prohibited, there's just a little dash there. If something needs a council use permit, you'll see a CUP. If something needs a special use permit, you'll see an SUP. We have footnotes. The footnotes are there basically to if there's like just a one or two line, rather than again have to flip back to another page someplace. The footnote is right there. Again, we're trying to get as much information as possible on that single page. And then if there's something that needs to be described a little bit more fully, if there's additional requirements that might go along with that, we'll cite the section. And so as you can see here, for example, in a recycling facility, that would be a requirement. It'd be permitted use in an M2 district as a by right basis. They would need a council use permit. But there's some standards that they have to look at, so they have to refer to Section 11-2022. So that's the idea.
I have a couple questions. Scott?
You have four use regulations, permitted, limited, SUP, CUP, and we're kind of flipping through the tables, and I don't see an L. So in what situations would you...
Limited use would be the ones that have footnotes. So, for example, if we take a look at the table that's up at the top here, you, for example, say outdoor storage is permitted and has footnote 5. Okay, so you go down to the bottom of the table, footnote 5 says accessory outdoor storage permitted only if confined to the rear one half the lot. So that's what the limitation is.
Okay, maybe I'm just getting nitpicky, but wouldn't it be better to put an L there? L5, and then they can say, okay, that's limited, I should go down and like put it permitted. Would that, I'm just trying to think if this is going to cause somebody some confusion at some point, I'm just confused.
Well, I mean, it basically is semantics. I mean, it's just adding another letter there. We're saying it is permitted. You just have to comply with five. So if it's P and a footnote, then it's a limited use. But if we can put an L there. That's not that big a deal. If that's what you want, that's what we'll do.
I'm not going to spend 20 minutes talking about it.
Okay.
We're going to move on right now.
We're trying to say yes. We want to be positive.
Positive.
Not limited.
Not limited. We don't want to limit it? Okay.
The answer is yes, but.
Okay. Yes, but.
There are...
I have one more question.
I'm sorry.
Vice Mayor.
Thank you. First of all, I think I finally learned all the zoning codes, and now you're going and changing them on me. Thank you so much, Gordon. I mean, zoning is this own, it's a language of its own. R143, R19, R2, R4, and now that isn't it anymore. My question, actually, I had the same question as Scott had, except that I also have the other side of it, which is when you get down to the descriptions, and by the way, this is so much better. I need to preface it by saying how wonderful this is. I have spent hours looking through for to find something, and it is so hard because you don't have that side by side. So this is great. But when you go into certain things, for instance, where a council use permit is required, if you go back into the category, unless you look at the chart, you don't know that the council use permit is required. Why not put in the description as well the council use permit requirement or the special use permit requirement?
Okay.
Let me give you an example. Okay. Go back and look at pawn shops.
Okay.
It goes through, you know, the separation, it goes through this, it goes through that, but nowhere does it say council use permit required unless you go to the chart.
Oh, okay. And I think part of that is because they, well, I'm putting words in the consultant's mouth. I'm, unfortunately, Diet's not here. I'm doing this.
You're the man.
Yeah. The part of that is that some of the uses will require council use permits in some districts. In other districts, they will not. And so some of the thought is that the standards would remain the same, whether it's a permitted use or a council use permit use. But we can do that. I mean, it's another line in that section that but it's a redundancy. If the redundancy helps, we can put it there. It's just it's not always the same requirement or review requirement in every district.
I think where it's the same across the board, I think it should be in there, or else footnoted or something if it's different.
Sure.
because I know that a lot of times when I go look, and I look at other people's city codes too, and I try and read, and I think, okay, now I got this figured out, and then I'll talk to a council member, oh, well, did you look at section such and such,
right,
which tells you something different than what you just read? And I think that's what I'm trying to eliminate, that, oh, you didn't look at both pages. Well, sorry about that.
Okay, sure.
Thank you.
Okay. There are six major tables that have to do with broad categories of uses: residential, public, commercial, employment or industrial, transportation, community and utilities, and then accessory uses and facilities. There will be classifications and subclassifications, and there's some flexibility we're trying to build into that. This kind of talks about the uses a little bit. There's additional regulations, and I should emphasize this is the first of four parts. We're trying to break down the code into manageable sections and try to deal and have the analysis come forward for each one. This one basically deals with land uses. You're going to see standards and design guidelines come through as a second section. There'll be a third module that's going to come through in the future that deals with processing. So we'll talk about how you go through a design review case, or how you go through a P&Z case, or through a board of adjustment case. And then a fourth one will talk about what we're calling it's kind of a grab bag. It's like overlay districts and all those types of things that don't fit neatly into one particular category will be a fourth module. We're proposing some changes to the zone names, and part of this is more to try to make them more intuitive. You're right. Some people, if you tell someone what a C1 district is or what an R4 district is, if they've been around a while and they've used the zoning code, they may have understood it. But we are proposing to change those, for example, to LC for limited commercial instead of, if I remember correctly, limited commercial would be C2. Or neighborhood commercial would be NC instead of C1. And so the idea is to make the acronym fit what we're already calling it. We are proposing some use types, and we're talking about some changes to some of the use standards. If you look at the module one, mine happens to be in a notebook, but take a look at that on page 5, there's a full list. We're not really imposing any new significant changes to that. We're not rezoning things, we're just renaming a few things. We're proposing to add some things that are new. Consolidation of uses, again, trying to classify things. And we're trying to recognize scale as a use question, so that not all retail items are going to be retail as a whole, but sometimes you're going to have small-scale retail and large-scale retail. Sometimes you're going to have small-scale gas stations and large-scale gas stations. And sometimes those make a difference in how you review those and how you impact them and how they impact things. Some other things. I'll just kind of go through the kind of get to the questions here real quick. I apologize for the spelling on this, by the way. I did this last night and I forgot to proof it, so please forgive me for that. Is the proposed table format and the use methodology acceptable? Or does that seem to be kind of the direction we want to do as opposed to the listing of things? Is that, okay, I'm kind of getting some nodding heads here. That seems to be okay.
Yep.
All right. I understand that talking about zoning is like talking about comedy or watching paint dry. I apologize for that. But it's one of those things we have to kind of work through, I guess. The proposed use classifications provide sufficient basis for determining which uses are appropriate for different districts. The idea is that our broad category is okay for the use and how we classify things. Is the idea of permitted, limited, and conditional uses, does that segregating those in a way by the zoning districts, does that help reflect the purpose of what that district's trying to accomplish? The idea being that, for example, in a neighborhood commercial district, you might have one use that's a special use permit, and in a general commercial district, it might be a permitted district. So that seems to follow what they're trying to accomplish with the general plan. We tried to get this out to you, so you might have had a chance to glance through this. Did you see anything in there, any particular uses that you felt needed some additional regulation outside of what we listed in the actual tables itself?
Vice Mayor.
I had one that I had a question on, and that was the mixed use, and I'm saying the wrong thing, but where you have, you know, you can have residential and the person can have like ground floor, mm-hmm. other kind of use. But it said that two-thirds of it had to be, I think it was 66%, had to be used for the commercial business purpose. And I wondered why. I mean, why would we care if somebody has a three-story and they put their law office on the main floor and they have their residence on the two stories up above? Why are we restricting them and saying, no, you have to have two floors for the law office and only one floor for residential?
Quite honestly, Mayor, Vice Mayor Walters, we can set that anywhere we want. He was using examples he's done in other communities and where he's actually done live-work units. And those communities have generally said, if you're going to be in a commercial district and have a residential component to that, they didn't want to lose the commercial aspect or the office aspect of that. So they wanted to set a floor area percentage based on the idea that this will maintain primarily a commercial or primarily an office feel or use. That'd be the primary use for that district. But we'd still allow residential to be part of that. We've had some internal discussions among staff about trying to set that more like 50% or make that allow more residential as part of that component. But again, we can set that bar anywhere we want.
And if you go back to the thought of you know, our TOD that we were talking about the other day, somebody comes in and builds a three-story, and they do that. They do the law office on the main floor. And I actually grew up, my grandparents lived behind they had an apartment behind the store. They operated the store, and then there were two apartments upstairs above them. And they also had the post office out front. Well, as time went on, you know, the percentage of that had to be allocated to the post office went up, the shop went down, that then became living space. I mean, things just sort of flexed over time, and I'm worried about that hard standard that really makes it not quite as attractive to maybe some of the urban professionals that we're looking for.
Just real quick to answer that, part of this also has to do with making sure it doesn't become 100% residential or 100% commercial.
Understood. And I can certainly understand that thought. And I just kept thinking about that three-story building and the one piece of it as that commercial business use, and then the other parts of it for a family. And that makes a lot of sense to me. So I'd like us to give further attention to that if we could, Mayor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other? Okay. Are there some uses? One of the things we want to talk about is the possibility of delegating some of the uses in terms of the review or the entitlement of, the, of where that use comes from. Rather than, for example, a council use permit, could something be a special use permit? Or if it's a special use permit, could we push that down to a limited use or to actually a permitted use and have staff review those things? So we could possibly take some of the, actually make your agenda smaller from that standpoint. Are there any particular activities that you think that, that we could do that to? Are you willing to consider those? Or would you like us to prepare a list and maybe come back later and take a look at that?
Payday loan stores here.
Okay.
I think the list of things to look through, I get some concurrence on that.
Okay.
I'm not sure we will when we vote, but at least to bring the list forward.
Sure. The what we're proposing to call general industrial, what we currently call M2, right now is a kind of a, it allows everything just about outside of a residential use. The way the current zoning ordinance is set up, an M2 district allows every use in the OS, C1, C2, C3, PEP, and M1 district. So it becomes kind of a catch-all for absolutely anything that you can have. One of the things that the consultant is recommending after taking a look at the general plan and taking and having some discussions, especially with employment-oriented folks, is that the M2 district should become more employment-driven and less commercial-driven. And that we would actually place additional restrictions in the M2 district, what we call it what's now the M2 district, that would take out some of the rights that are currently there now for commercial activity. For example, in the M2 district, you're allowed to have a commercial business up to 10,000 square feet and then a shopping center up to 50,000 square feet by right. And he's saying that in talking with some of the employment folks that they wouldn't necessarily want to put a chemical factory or an industrial manufacturing use next to a commercial shopping center. That's not something that attracts them to an employment type of zoning district. And so some of the thought that we have here is to maybe remove some of those commercial activities from the and have a true hard industrial district.
Vice Mayor.
I have a couple of questions on that. The first one is, how does 207 come into play on that? Do you want me to give you all my questions at once? Or?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, that's certainly something we're looking at. And because 207 hasn't been tested in the courts yet, the interpretation is unclear. But there are ways to deal with it. And one of the ways is similar to the way we've dealt with the TOD ordinance, which is we have this new zoning district, but we do not force changes in the land use. So we kind of have a dual application. And if someone wants to come in for a rezoning, they have to rezone under the new code. But as long as they stay under the current code, they can use it in the same manner that they can today. So that's one way we're looking at that.
Okay, that actually makes sense. And the second question that I have is that would that trigger for us re-looking at the whole general plan? Because when we adopted the general plan, we knew what the uses, the potential uses were within those zoning codes. So are we going to want to go back and look at the general plan? And maybe I'm looking at you, Mayor, on that one.
I think it actually clarifies it a little bit more. It would make it more the heavy industrial, light industrial, instead of having that hodgepodge of uses that are currently allowed. But you get into the whole, you know, if it's a chemical plant, I don't think the chemical plant can guarantee that all of their neighbors will be compatible uses the way it is now. Mm-hmm. But if they wanted to have all compatible uses, they should have purchased a bigger site, is I guess the other way of looking at it, that we shouldn't hold out commercial or corner locations that somebody else has acquired and not let them do. I think that this is one where, so far, this council said that it's not residential use, but otherwise it's going to be market-driven and not zoning-driven. So I'm reluctant to change very far on that. There may be a way to tweak it a little bit on the category, and have some exclusions that are definitely in conflict, but I'm not sure that they are now. And if you have a chemical plant, hopefully it's not a bad neighbor anyway, that they have the technology so that people wouldn't mind being next to them.
especially in an urban environment. So I'm not sure that's a good example.
Okay. If I may, the table that I've brought up real quickly kind of is the table that is one portion of the employment table, table 3. And the types of things that they would be talking about, you can see under food and beverage sales, it would be convenience market, liquor stores. In essence, they would be prohibited uses in the M2 district. You wouldn't be allowed to have a live-work unit, but hotels and motels would be permitted. You'd be allowed to have nurseries and garden centers. There would be limitations on just straight office uses. But retail sales that's something we can take a look at, possibly allow, maybe even go back and allow the convenience market, because that allows up to 5,000 square feet, so that we can allow that activity, but as opposed to, a larger shopping center.
Right. Where is this chart at that you pulled up?
It's in the module.
Okay.
14?
11?
13 and 14.
Yeah, it's 13 and 14. It's table 3. And this part of it, the retail and commercial stuff, would be starting on page 13.
Aren't you going to have non-conforming uses, too, if we go to this?
He's already taken it. Yeah.
The current code, the table that you see in front of you right now is not current code. This is if I can make that clear. These are things that the consultant is recommending, actions that we recommend to bring the zoning ordinance closer into compliance with his reading of the general plan. So, I should make that clear. This hasn't been done, and it doesn't necessarily reflect what the current zoning ordinance states.
All right. Here, did you have a question about going from the code to non-conforming rights? Is that?
Well, there will be some areas that are currently employment district kind of categories that we currently have, and we call it
We've got the PEP, the M1, and the M2 are the current employment categories.
Okay, but in an M1, you are allowing uses that may not be compatible by having some retail and stuff in there. Is that one of the issues? I guess there will be some non-conforming then?
I should mention that there's not a lot of M2 in the city. Most of the industrial activities that are taking place now are usually in M1. Or PEP.
Yeah, and I know the town center eliminated it when they went to the TC.
Right.
Town center districts and that.
So in terms of creating a lot of nonconformities out there, what it would essentially do is for the existing chemical plants, for the existing rock quarry that's north of Boeing, there's a couple of properties that are along Broadway that have been primarily industrial activities they've already developed at a heavy industrial use. This would limit their ability to redevelop into a commercial activity. But for the most part, this zoning as being proposed would already reflect the activity that's already there.
Okay.
There are very few. I had our GIS staff take a look at this yesterday. There's approximately 3,000 acres of M2 zoning in the city, which is about 3% of the total for the city itself, and almost all of those are heavy industrial users. The past city councils have been very discreet in how in actually approving M2 zoning only for those sites that actually need it.
So the concept from the consultant is that's important zoning, protect it, and make sure that type of heavy use is still allowed, and don't take it away and diminish it by letting retail or something else sneak in there.
And then the other part of that is from the heavy industrial user standpoint is that they generally don't want to locate next to someone who might have the ability to put in a shopping center next door. They generally want to isolate themselves and locate next to other users that have similar type of heavy industrial needs.
Mayor, I think that's going to be really important for District 6 around that airport, where we're going to have some identifying some really heavy industry, if we're going to have some manufacturing jobs and industries coming in, if this is going to help attract them, knowing that that area around them, that zoning is fairly well protected and they're going to be able to operate, this would be a good change in that direction.
If you want to think of it, I know this is kind of a tough question to kind of throw out and hit you all at one time, and maybe you need to think through it. It's certainly a question that we can bring back later and ask the council after they had a chance to go through and kind of think through both sides of this.
Well, I can certainly see the industrial user on the edge of the zone, that, and there can be some creep going in where it's not very disruptive, but to put somebody right in the middle of one could be. But to not have some type of way of transitioning a community depending on what type of uses and needs and land use, and to restrict that industrial user to not have a high to put in a less intense use for his property, I have a little difficulty in conceptually agreeing with that.
Mayor, past councils in some cases where they've had a particularly heavy general industrial type of activity on a relatively large site has agreed to split the zoning or use two zoning districts on the same parcel, where they might use M2 on the part of the parcel where actually the heavy industrial activity takes place, but on the perimeter as it transitions out toward other activities, it might use M1. Mm-hmm. An example of that would be both the Tally site, the TRW site that are up north of Falcon Field, the gravel quarry that's north of the Boeing helicopter plant have used that, where they've got primarily M2 zoning for the majority of the site, but then it would have anywhere between a 50 to 150 foot M1 buffer along the perimeter to kind of transition back out and still allow, so, and the M1 is, we're not changing that. They would still allow the plethora uses in commercial districts as it allows today.
Well, that makes sense, but that's not what I've heard this say. I've heard this say it's going to lock it in and they can't go to M1 for the rest of that area if they wanted to in some future date.
If a person came through and proposed M2 zoning right now, then they would have M2 zoning just for that site, and we would apply M2 zoning to the parcels as they come through. That would be their voluntary choice. The folks who have M2 now, certainly if they wanted to add a commercial component to an M2 activity, you're right, it would limit their rights that way, but in all likelihood they're probably in an area where other M2 activities have gone on in that same area, so there's that, it's kind of a reverse compatibility situation. Mm-hmm. Are you going to remain compatible with the folks who've located next to you because you were also zoned M2?
All right. Good discussion. That's a good philosophical one too, on property rights and land use and transitions of a community, and whether heavy industrial uses are really what we're going to be like in 20 or 50 years too. And but yet we're trying to say we're locking into that type of land use in those areas without, I guess, going through a full rezoning of the, well, I guess you can always, well, it would be a rezoning. We'd have to look at it, and depending on the acreage, it could be a one that ever only comes up once a year. What's the
general plan
amendment? Yeah,
Mayor, the acreage. Yeah. Yeah. We have the major and minor general plan amendment. That's different than a rezoning, and
but this, if it's in the general plan and it's enough acreage, it could trip that too, that requirement.
The 3,000 acres is spread throughout the entire city. It's not just
if, in fact, the C1 or something isn't permitted any longer. If we change this, then it's a general plan amendment, I believe.
For rezoning,
I don't think so. But we'll
all right.
Consider that some more.
Okay.
We can also provide you with a map that shows the locations of existing M2 also.
I follow your logic on what you're trying to do, but I also have this intuitive sense that landowners are smart enough that they'll figure that out by themselves, and we shouldn't be dictating it. And I kind of like that broad land use category to have some flexibility. Okay. So, but I would be interested if the council has thought this through. And all right.
Hi, Mayor, I've got a question.
Mr. Truitt.
When I've seen this done in other communities, when you've changed the zoning code like this, do you go back then and start rezoning everybody's property? In other words, if they had M1, you change them to L1, et cetera?
As we're proposing now, Mr. Truitt, we would not have to do that because we're just changing the name. So if we're, because, for example, if you take a look at, I know the existing zoning code, the M1 district has a kind of a subtitle that's at the end of it. It's already called limited industrial. All we would be doing basically is removing M1 from that and just going to the initials LI.
Well, except that you're proposing certain little tweaks in this chart.
I'm sorry?
You are proposing certain?
No, this is not for certain. That we're proposing these right now, and we're trying to get council direction to see if these are acceptable.
Okay.
But
let's,
I think Mr.
Let's assume that we do put some of the tweaks in the chart, then do you have to go out there and change their zoning?
I don't.
That's going to depend on the direction of the council. Does the council want us to affirmatively rezone to make the new zoning code applicable to all property, or will we have this kind of dual application where as long as the individual is not rezoning his property, he can remain with the uses he currently has a right to use? But anyone that comes in to rezone will have to comply with the new zoning code.
But, Mayor, you'll end up with two codes. Mm-hmm. And I've seen cities have had three codes or more. And I know it's this balance of being fair, but then the application and the enforcement, you really do have to hold on to the old code until that transition. And that may be the way it has to be done, but it does become a very complicating issue.
And I'll just add, to make it a little more complicated, it also depends on the land use versus the process. We believe we can go forward with whatever new process this new code has. We can probably move forward with that on all land because that's not a land use change, so it would not trigger 207. So to try and make sure that staff can streamline the process and we're not actually having two, three different processes in place at the same time, we can use the same zoning designation and the same use with the two different codes, but the processes will probably all be in the new code. But those are things we're still working through.
But I think Mr. Truitt's zeroing in on the question that I have is if, in fact, we adopt this, what is the impact of the landowner on his options? And it seems like some of the options for the landowner that he currently has would be eliminated. That's what I'm trying to clarify.
If we adopted one code and all current M2 districts were transferred into this new GI category, mm-hmm. what you're saying is true. If we transition into a new code and keep an old code, new code scenario, then no, he wouldn't lose anything.
And Mayor, that'll be a decision for council when we get further down the road.
Well, I'm probably more comfortable with the two code thing because I think otherwise you're taking away a land use that is currently, they bought that property with the idea that that was something they had an option to do. Mr. Truitt, you want to follow up on your question?
No.
All right. Bonnie?
And that was my question about the 207 thing, and your answer was we would do it like we did the TOD. We would run them simultaneously. Now you're saying that that's council direction. I apologize. I have a sinus infection. I know I sound horrible. One of the things here that I'm looking at is it appears to me that you don't have this conflict with every single category. And so where there is no conflict, you just go through and you just rename it. And there are only a couple of them here where you're going to have to run the dual zoning.
Right.
But I agree with you, Kino. I mean, if they bought that land with that, I don't think you can take it away. And I don't think you should take it away. The other, and this is a correction. I went through and had been looking at your item on page 13, so this is one you might want to send to the guys back there on 13 where it talks about schools, public or private, and I was trying to follow up last night on finding section 11-20-24. And I did find 11-20-24, which has to do with service stations. Had I looked above it, I would have seen that I was just, they had put the wrong number in. So they might want to fix that and make it 11-20-23. Do we really have the ability, and I know we've had this conversation, but it's been enough years that I don't remember the answer to this question. Do we really have the ability to tell another public entity that they cannot construct a school in any zoning category where they want to?
I'll let you.
Let me look to Donna. She can jump up if I'm incorrect. My general understanding is, no, they can construct the school, but we can give them guidelines in terms of the structure, in terms of, you know, the height, the structure itself, construction guidelines.
So given that, then having a CUP, for me, Gordon, this goes back to your question about are there any categories. Well, this would be one of them. If they have the right to construct, but we give them certain guidelines that they have to meet in order to construct, then I think that we say, okay, here are the guidelines. Now you can get approval through our zoning administrator rather than coming to the council for a council use permit. This would be one of those categories where I would say, since they have the right but just have to meet certain qualifications, I would change this one.
You know, I've got a suggestion there, though. It says schools, public or private. And I have seen these charter schools put themselves anywhere and everywhere. And I don't know that you want them in M2 districts and things like that. I don't see the public school districts doing things like that, but charter schools go where the...
And Darrell, I absolutely agree with you, but legally, a charter school is a public school, and therefore they have the rights. As a matter of fact, it creates all kinds of problems for us, because then you put a charter school into a strip mall. Somebody comes in and they want to put a liquor store in there, and now they have a school within 300 feet. And I think the state ought to address that issue, because it creates a problem for us and has created a problem for us in different places in the city. And it's not that I'm out there advocating liquor licenses everywhere in the world. I'm just saying that that's one of those things that comes up as a result of it.
One of the things that we can do, in terms of the public school districts, no, we don't necessarily drive the locations. The school district buys the property. We have less authority over where they actually locate. Charter schools, however, it's a public school, but for whatever reason, someone explained it and I've forgotten it, but we do have zoning authority over a charter school. And so we can tell charter schools that they cannot locate in an industrial district or they cannot locate in a commercial district. Past councils have had a particular issue with some of the charter schools and taking up valuable industrial properties. And so that's why they imposed the CUP requirement. And so, I mean, if we can clarify this by saying schools, public, charter, or private, or we can just say charter or private and just take public out of it. And so it makes it more clear that the public school districts will do whatever the public school district decides they're going to do. But this regulation is really being imposed on charter schools as well as private schools.
Okay, Donna, can you clarify that?
Yes, Mayor and Vice Mayor. The statutes specifically provide that all the health safety kind of codes apply to charter schools as apply to apply to all the schools. So the fire codes and the building codes, all those kinds of uniform code things apply to schools as well as everybody else. So those rules are the same. We don't have a lot of zoning control over the schools to the extent that they are considered separate governmental entities, because we've got the issue of one government not having jurisdiction over another governmental entity. The line is a little murky when you start talking about the charter schools, because in some ways they get treated as public schools and in some ways they don't. So, and I don't want to I can't give you that exact line. It's because it is a little murky, and every time I go back and I read the statutes and the cases, because it just isn't a bright line. So we can come back to you with some clarifications if you have specific issues, but everything people have been saying are different aspects of the same issue. So just to summarize, because I know that was confusing.
Well, I agree with Daryl on this. If there is an ability for us to have some additional control, I think that, you know, we ought to go for it. But my understanding had been different than that. So
we've been regulating charter schools since their inception. Okay. In terms of the location. In fact, there's a, if I remember correctly, I don't know if Terry's here, still or not. I think there's something in the building code that actually exempts school entities of less than 2,000 people, or more than 2,000 people, specifically because of public schools, and most charter schools won't have 2,000 kids. So therefore, the building code aspects become effective to all schools less than 2,000 kids. So that, and that was, again, something that the council passed in the mid-90s when the charter school thing came about.
Okay. Well, that's
building, not land use.
Exactly. Yeah.
Correctly, but again, the zoning, it was also, we think the way that it's written, it's also applicable to the zoning ordinance, because we've done the same. Because I know I've told several charter school folks that we have zoning authority. I haven't been challenged on that. They've never asked me for an interpretation otherwise.
And I shouldn't have said my understanding. I should have said my recollection, because honestly, it's been so long since we've discussed it. I probably, at one point in time, you explained this before, Gordon, and I've just forgotten. I want to retain that for the reasons that I talked about, for the reasons that Daryl talked about. I want to retain that if we can. But in terms of the school district schools, I think we've got I just think it's one of those things that, why bring it to us when we have to approve it? As long as they meet those certain criteria, just go ahead and run it administratively.
Right. I think there's also, if I'm not mistaken, for the process of charter schools, some time frames that the city has to comply with on building permits and the rest. Or,
that's right. That's correct.
So that's another issue, another nuance that they happen to get legislative support for, and we have to comply with.
Exactly.
Okay. Right. Okay. And then let's see if we can go. Oh, the accessory living quarters question. Mm-hmm. We're proposing some major changes to how we. Oops. I went one too far. Anyway, we're proposing some major changes to how we deal with accessory living quarters. Currently, there's a six-part criteria that's in the zoning ordinance. They cannot be leased or rented, and to be as a by right use, they have to be functionally attached to the primary dwelling. What we're proposing is to kind of loosen up the regulations, so to speak, because we have a suspicion, we don't know this, and we haven't done a study of this. We have a feeling that some folks may be leasing or renting these anyway, even though you're not supposed to.
Just this feeling.
You hear things.
Yeah.
One of the things is you're now allowed to do it in attached by right. We're proposing to keep that. If it's detached, it's a special use permit. We've heard, I think last I looked at this, something like 125 or 150 of these since the council loosened up the regulation in 1992. Every single one of them have been approved for a detached special use permit. We see no reason to keep the special use permit requirement. And the reason that the council had required the special use permit previously was this concern that people might be creating a second dwelling on their lot. And we think there's another way to address that problem without necessarily having to go through a public review process. And part of this is that, go ahead and say they can be leased or rented. This would be Fonzie over the garage at the Cunninghams. But that, is that necessarily a bad thing in a single residence district? And we're kind of saying that might actually add some incentive for some folks to go in
and redevelop some of the older single residence areas because it provides the person who's actually living on the property with the opportunity to make some income by renting out an apartment or renting out a space above the garage or a space in the back. Where we would address this to avoid the idea of becoming a duplex is the idea of the size of the structure itself. Currently, the ordinance says that you can have up to one half the size of the primary dwelling. Well, if you have a 2,000 square foot house, that means you can have a 1,000 square foot apartment. That's getting kind of big. And so what we're thinking is that if we reduce that to 30%, then this would remain more of the studio type of apartment and reduce the impact. So you're not getting the three-bedroom apartments or the two-bedroom apartments. This would become a one-bedroom or a studio type of thing and keep it relatively small, keep the impact relatively low. The current ordinance says that they have to have same utilities. We're proposing possibility of saying that they could have separate utilities. This is just functional and makes it a little bit easier to construct the detached structure. They would still have to be placed within the buildable lot area. This is going to control them from being placed right on a property line, right in the back and the rear setback, or on the rear property line or on the side property line. They're saying this would have to meet the same setbacks as you would have for that zoning district. So they still have to meet the 10-foot or the 7-foot in an R19 district on the side, the 25-foot rear setback in the R19 district also. Again, one per lot. And then we would add the requirement that they would have to be architecturally compatible with the primary dwelling. So in essence, they would have to pick up things like the primary building materials. If it's stucco for the house, then if it's detached, it would have to also be stucco. If they're going to use, if they have tile roof, then they would have to use a tile roof. If they have a shingle roof, they would have to use the same shingles. The idea is that it gives more an appearance that it's part of the home itself. It's not necessarily detached or separate or appears separate.
Thanks, ma'am.
I have some questions about this, Gordon. And I think we all know somebody whose newlywed kids are living in somebody's former mother-in-law quarter someplace. My question is, how do you keep it from taking over, like let me just use my home as an example. So I have a home that's like 3,000 square feet. I can now build in my backyard a 1,500 square foot guest mother-in-law quarters, you know, father-in-law quarters. My mother comes and lives there. My mother passes on, and now I decide I'm going to rent this. But it 1,000 square feet in my backyard, even maintaining the rear yard setback and the side yard setbacks, could essentially eat my entire yard. And so what you would have next to you is just massive house and then other smaller house that has taken over everything. Mm-hmm. Have you addressed that in any way to require some yard remaining? Or
one is that if you're within the buildable area, there'll still be like 25-foot rear yard setback. That's not proposed to change. The other aspect of this is we're not proposing to change what's referred to as the roof coverage requirement for the lot. In addition to everything else, the zoning ordinance specifies that, for example, in the R16 and R17 district, you can cover up to 40% of your lot with roof area. And so, on a 6,000 square foot lot, your maximum roof area is 2,400 square feet. And so, I mean, if you had a 2,000 square foot house, you could only build 400 square feet of roof area.
Okay, that takes care of it. Thank you.
What about parking?
We haven't proposed to change the parking requirements. That's something we're still trying to address. The parking regulations would come as part of Module 3, and so we would probably try to incorporate that review as part of that overall review of parking when that comes through the module after the next one.
As long as it does get addressed somewhere.
Sure.
Yeah, well, there's additional parking required if you're adding another building to the backyard for a lease or rental. Otherwise, it's all going to be put out on the street.
Well, for example, now you don't permit people to store cars on residential lots, do you?
That's correct.
So now you get somebody that moves into that apartment and their car doesn't move for 6 months in the backyard, and it just seems like it's going to be more enforcement.
It we're part of the initial thinking is that if they are going to be a detached facility, we would require one additional parking space. Right now, a single residence district requires, or a single a home in a single residence district requires two spaces. If they build a detached structure, then it would require a third space. If it was attached, then generally we would not require it to the additional space, because then it's generally, it is a mother's-in-law quarters. It would, at least it would fit the old definition of mother-in-law's quarters. But again, we're reviewing that. We'll bring that back as part of the whole parking idea with the third module.
How do you prevent it from being just a second house, I guess, that's a rental, and maybe that's what you're encouraging, and you build a little driveway along the side of your yard to get access to the back, and it's really a subdivision that now has other houses being built in backyards of all the subdivision, and I'm not sure that that is necessarily bad if it's compatible and looks good, but boy, the nature of the subdivision will certainly change in a hurry because of the volume of residents that are living there, if nothing else. And
I guess I would answer that with two ways.
One, you mentioned there's only 125 or something came through, so I don't think it's going to be, but let's take it to the extreme that it did catch on and everybody thought, income source. I'll build another house in my backyard and I'll lease it out and I'll blow a driveway through next to me and my neighbor and I'll do the setbacks and got a garage in back and a little house and it's like another whole modification to the subdivision. Instead of having one house, you put two on each lot.
Mayor, I guess I would address that question two ways. One is we still have the lot coverage requirement, so that still really does control the amount of roof area that goes on a property. Two, in the smaller lot subdivisions, the R16 and the R17, quite frankly, they don't have the room. They're lucky to have 10 feet on one side of the lot, and oftentimes that 10 feet is used for other things. To try to sit here and blow a driveway through there to access the rear yard, oftentimes they don't even have the room for that. We're constantly trying to get people to take things like pool equipment and air conditioning, ground-mounted air, all that type, out of the 10-foot side yard. Otherwise, they can't get any kind of vehicular access into the rear yard at all.
So anybody with alley access would not be permitted?
Alley access would actually solve that issue in terms of the access to the rear yard. Generally, where we've seen most of these take place have been the larger lot subdivisions. The large homes that are in the Las Sendas area, the custom homes that are being built in the Citrus area, some of the R19 districts where they might have oversized lots that are, say, between 10 and 15,000 square feet, that's where we're seeing most of this activity.
Yeah. Some of the older neighborhoods that have alleys, this may switch that whole debate because there may be one person that wants to keep the alley so they can access their back separate living quarters.
Yeah. So, all right. Let me just make one statement. I think the whole discussion here was, should we take this from a special use permit to an administrative? I think that's what they were proposing. And I guess is, could we do both? Could we give them the flexibility to do it in administrative, but if they feel like it's something the council ought to see, can they bump it up to a special use permit?
Councilmember Truitt, that's kind of the current code has the 6-part criteria. If they don't meet all 6 criteria, if they meet 6 criteria, it's by right. There's no public review. It's all done through their building permits. If they don't meet any one of the 6 criteria, then it's a special use permit, and it's heard through the Board of Adjustment or the Zoning Administrator. We've done it generally that way because it's a little bit quicker to get the Zoning Administrator Hearing Officer. It's only 4 weeks, as opposed to going through a 4-month process. If you had to go up to council, for example, or somewhere between 5 and 7 weeks to go to Board of Adjustment. But like I said, for the most part, every single one has been approved. By going to a by right situation for detached units, we're just kind of recognizing what basically has already happened for the last 15 years.
Okay, I think we have some clear, non-concise comments coming forward here. I think the concept in some manner sounds good, but
we need some additional work.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's the type to, and the coverage of the lot may take care of a lot of it. I guess I would almost need to see some neighborhoods and plot some houses on it, which would allow it, which wouldn't, what it would look like after the fact if we do it by use by right. I'm trying to visualize my neighbor now putting a secondary house, you know, in his backyard, and whether, you know, the what I'm used to enjoying with a little, at least a little over open space, you don't, and then if it's two-story, or, you know, how is that going to be addressed? So I'm just not real comfortable with this one quite yet.
Okay. So we'll keep working on it and come back. All right. That's all I have.
Okay. Let's then go to item number four, which is the acknowledging receipts. I have a motion. Is there a second? Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Good. One, two, three, four. Got four. All right. Here reports on meetings and our conferences. Let me pass this out real quick. Had the meeting yesterday with a bunch of mayors and the governor, and one of the suggestions was to do a scorecard. And I need a little bit of feedback from the council members on whether we want to participate. The concept would be if there was some discretionary money and you were a city that met a lot of these criteria for citizen involvement and master planning and water use, and there's just an assortment of different scorecard activity, that you would be ranked higher in the process of getting additional funds to contribute, to move towards your next project, whatever that might be, that's current funding allocation. I'd like the concept of the scorecard, but I'd like to suggest that we request that it be done in a manner in which we can compare city-to-city performance more on a quantitative basis. We've requests for response times and officers per thousand, and but I don't think statewide there's ever been the right pattern of here's what goes into computing that so that everybody's on an equal playing field. So that's what I would like to suggest to the governor and this task force, and the feedback comes in here, I guess, in the next couple of months, and then they want, I guess, not till through 2008, March 3rd, 2008. Or we can send this to a subcommittee if a subcommittee wants to look at it. And take a peek. All right, so Intergov, all right. Why don't we then send this on over to Intergov committee to take a look. And if you would consider, if we're going to take the time to fill this thing out, that there's a beneficial use back to Mesa. Because if there isn't any additional money coming forward, I think the data would still be useful. We also do comparisons on cost to live in a community. But what's it based on? Let's make sure that all the cities are putting in the same information and that there's a yearly update or something. So I think there may be some positives that could come from it. So that was the one I wanted to report on. Anybody else? Vice Mayor.
Mayor, we had simultaneous openings yesterday of three Fresh and Easy markets in Mesa. One that was where we did the ribbon cutting for all three of them was at University and Alma School, but we have several others in the community. And one of the things that I really appreciate about what they've done is they have come in and taken buildings that had been, and particularly in the case of the one at Alma School and University, it had been a store that had been built in the midst of the drugstore wars, and it was empty, and they came in and they've got a good reuse in it. There's no check cashing in there other than, you know, if you write a check for your groceries. So I'm glad to see that kind of a use coming in. As I went back yesterday for the ribbon cutting, I had spied out things, Mayor, when you and I were there the night before for their little preview thing that I was going to buy, and I will say I got a few things, and my husband and I had a very nice dinner that I just had to, you know, like 6 minutes in the microwave, and it tasted homemade and it was very good. So there's my plug for them. It, you know, on a busy night, that worked out really well for us.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. Scheduling the meetings and general information, Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a reminder, next we'll have another study session next Thursday, December 13th, and that will be followed by a transportation and infrastructure meeting. And also the during the 14th and 13th and 14th of this month, that same Thursday and the following Friday, we'll have the land use workshops out at ASU Polytechnic for the Mesa Gateway Strategic Plan. And then our next council meeting will be Monday, December 17th. Thank you.
I have no request to speak this meeting. This
morning.
I have a motion and second to adjourn. All in favor say aye.
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 Right. Daryl, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.